Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You essentially identify major players, do a deal with them, make arrangements whereby they pay you off and you put favours their way.
We've got more villains in our game than you've got in yours.
This is Stealing Victory, the untold story of the 1966 World Cup heist. Episode 5, A Firm Within a Firm. The theft of the Jules Rimet Trophy sparked a series of rapidly unfolding events. Over the course of a week, the making of a fake trophy was secretly commissioned. A suspect was arrested in an undercover sting, and the owner of a dog called Pickles found it. Pickles became the story, but more remained hidden below the surface. I'm Tom Pettifor, crime editor at the Daily Mirror. According to the police reports from the National Archives, when Betchley was arrested, he said he could get the cup back.
Listen, I didn't steal the cup, and honestly, I don't know where it is now. God's given truth. But if you give me bail, I'll get it back for you. It was never meant for the melting pot. I can get it for you, I promise.
If Betchley was telling the truth in his interview with detectives, there must have been others working with him. He said he didn't know where the cup was, but could get it back, implying there had to be at least one other person involved. And according to the police files, he had talked about we, not I, when referring to the theft during the sting. Betchley had been caught in an undercover police operation trying to extort money for the cup. He was then picked out in an ID parade as having been at the scene of the crime. So the case against him looked cut and dried, but the theft charges would later be abandoned. And 2 days after he was arrested, the cup appeared in a suburban South London street. We've already heard how Dave Corbett was walking Pickles the dog when he found it. But how did it get there?
I've always believed that my father acted as an intermediary between the police, the FA, the government and the thieves themselves, because it was such an embarrassment to have had the cup stolen on their watch.
That's journalist Frank Baldwin. I went to speak to him at his home in Kent after spotting a letter he had written to his local newspaper. Frank's father, Freddie, had been Betchley's solicitor.
I think the thieves actually went in to this place to steal something else, saw the cup was on display, and so couldn't resist taking it. But once they had it, they actually couldn't do anything with it except possibly melt it down. But it was a real embarrassment, as of course we were just about to hold the World Cup in England and we had no World Cup. My father first defended Edward Betchley, and I think that he had some connection with the actual thieves, and that's where a deal was done. The process, I think, how it worked was that Betchley was caught in the sting when he tried to demand money back for the World Cup's return, and I think he took a fall for them because they did some kind of deal behind the scenes with Betchley to say, well, look, if you can get the cup back, we will shorten your sentence. My father probably acted as a go-between between the authorities, I said in this case the FA, the police and the government, and the thieves to get the cup back, which is why it's all very strange it being found under a bush, etc. There might have been someone else involved because my father, would, as a solicitor, wouldn't have got his hands dirty in all this and he wouldn't have been involved in any skullduggery, but he might have just oiled the wheels, as it were.
The lawyer, Freddie Baldwin, was from Bermondsey on the south bank of the Thames. In the 19th century, much of the area was slum housing. The building of the docks during the period brought money and employment to the area, but it remained a poor neighbourhood. It's a short walk from the Woolworth Road, where my source told me a thief called Sidney Q was from. He claimed Q had stolen the cup and got away with it. I learned more of the history of the place while co-writing a book about Brian Reader, the thief who planned the 2015 Hatton Garden heist. He was from nearby Greenwich. Much of the area south of the Thames was the home of families who had not moved for generations. It fostered a strong community and often a culture of disregard for the law, where outsiders were viewed with suspicion. It also had a tradition for producing professional criminals. criminals who would often need a lawyer.
For all the reasons you've just explained, he was never short of work. So, you know, he had plenty of clients around there. When I was a toddler, I can remember walking around Bermondsey sometimes when we'd go up to see his mum and dad, and we'd walk into a shop or something and he'd chat away and he said, "Well, that bloke used to be inside for murder," or "I got that bloke off for something." So, you know, it was always around. And there was a hypocritical story that in Wandsworth Prison on one of the walls was written, "If you want to get out of here, call for Baldwin." Yeah. Now, again, I'm not sure if that's true, but I think that's how he was respected amongst both sides of the law, because he was always known as being so honest.
Yeah.
So the criminals trusted him and the police trusted him as well. And even some police officers who I believe got themselves into trouble a few times used to come to him to act for them, because he was seen as a safe pair of hands, if you want.
A major figure in Baldwin's firm was Harry Stevens, the chief clerk and day-to-day point man for the practice. Harry was also from Bermondsey and one of 11 children from a family of dockers.
And he always joked that he was the first Englishman to lift the World Cup, because he happened to be at the police station when they brought the cup in, and somebody put it down on the table and everybody was rushing around sort of going, "Oh, you know, we found the cup." And so as he was looking at it, he picked it up and held it above his head. So just like Bobby Moore eventually did, so he could say that he was the first Englishman to lift it.
As we'll hear in later episodes, he wasn't the only Englishman to make this claim. So Frank's version is that the chief clerk from the law firm representing Bletchley just happened to be in Gypsy Hill Police Station when Dave Corbett burst in with the trophy. Quite a coincidence. But maybe it didn't happen. There is another version. Just as Frank Baldwin recalls everybody in Bermondsey knowing his dad, Harry Stevens' son Patrick also has fond memories of how well connected and respected his dad was.
My son has grown up on my stories of my dad to him. Excuse me, I'm getting slightly emotional at this one. But about 6 or 7 years ago, longer, I had tickets for my wife and my daughter to go and see Coldplay at the Emirates. And my son, to my surprise, at about the age of 6 or 7, said, "I wish I could have gone." And it was the day of the concert. And he was really upset and I felt really bad that I hadn't got him a ticket. So I said, "Look, come on, let's go down to the Emirates. Let's see what's floating about outside and see if we can get a ticket. If we can get a ticket at a reasonable price, then I'll buy us two tickets and we'll go in." And I came out of the station at Arsenal and saw a first person selling tickets. And I said, "How much for tickets?" He said, £300 each. And I said to Charlie, my son, "I'm not paying £300 each." So we walked along a bit further and we saw a guy, obvious tout. I suppose he was about my age. And I went up to him and said, "How much for your tickets?" And he said, £300 a ticket. I said, "Oh, I can't." He said, "Come on." He said, "That's what they're worth." I said, "No, I'm not paying them." And I turned to my son. This is a true story. I turned to my son. So this is 16 years after my dad's died, 20 years after he's retired. I turned to my son and said, "We wouldn't have had this trouble if your granddad was still alive." I said, "He could get us tickets for anything." And the bloke went, "Who's your granddad then?" I said, "Oh, he's just a defence solicitor guy from South London." He said, "What's his name?" I said, "Harry Stevens." He went, "Oh, you got me by the bollocks now." He said, "He was only my solicitor." He said, "Look, I'll do you a deal." He said, "One for your dad, you know." Then he gave me the tickets. He said, "Yeah, he represented me when I got arrested up in Cardiff for touting, you know."
Harry Stevens may have become one of the most well-known and respected legal clerks of his generation, but he almost followed a very different path. He was an entertainer who took a screen test for a gig that eventually went to Bruce Forsyth. But having just become a father, Harry Stevens chose a more secure option and took a job at Baldwin's firm. He would play a central role in some of the biggest trials of the 1960s. Newsreel footage shows Harry accompanying Christine Keeler from the Old Bailey in 1963. Keeler's affair with John Profumo had led to the Minister for War resigning. It was the biggest British political scandal of the decade. So Freddie and Harry's services were hugely in demand, not least among South London criminals. They were very well connected to the police as well. So what of the story about Harry having been at Gypsy Hill Police Station when the cup was handed in? This is Harry telling the story himself at his 70th birthday party in 1992.
The reward for finding that was £6,000 odd, and finding that jewel was a remade trophy, which was in a garden. I said to Eddie Betchley, well, you might have told me where it was. But anyway, it came to what we call the preliminary hearing before you go to the Old Bailey, which was then being held in Bow Street Court. And it was very, very, everybody, all the press were there, everybody was there. And the courtroom was packed. So before the magistrate came in, which again you'll understand, Freddie, before the magistrate came in, there was this Jules Rimet trophy there, and I held it aloft, both hands, getting everybody in the courtroom chanting, England, England! Little did we realise that, of course, within a few months or a couple of weeks, it was going to be England, England, actually with Bobby Moore holding it aloft. So hard luck, Bob.
So in Harry's version, told at his 70th birthday party, he didn't lift it in the police station, but at Betchley's magistrate's court hearing. That is also the version that his son Patrick told me.
That was one of Dad's favourite little anecdotes about that case.
But you weren't sure if that was correct, that the cup would have been in court, but this newspaper cutting from the Evening Express from April the 16th, 1966, has the headline, World Cup shown in court. So it was definitely there as an exhibit at the committal hearing at Bow Street Magistrates Court.
Yeah, that's a wonderful twist for me because and it just goes to show, doesn't it? My dad always had a phrase when he was talking about work, and I would sometimes talk to him about the dilemmas of representing people. You know, the classic phrase that people who defend people get asked, you know, how do you defend people you know are guilty? And he would say, if you've seen the things that I've seen over the years, you would know that truth is stranger than fiction.
So, as with all stories, they change each time with the telling. As individuals, families and nations, we all have our stories. Frank has his version of his family history, while Patrick has another. Crucially, the theft charges against Betchley were dropped when he later appeared at the Old Bailey, but he pleaded guilty to two counts of demanding cash with menaces. This was a charge that could attract a life sentence under the old Larceny Act of 1916. So the police and the prosecution had serious leverage over Betchley. But in the end, he was jailed for just 2 years. Not long, you might think, for demanding £15,000 for the return of the World Cup. Patrick followed his father's footsteps and became a senior lawyer for the Crown Prosecution Service. He has led some of the most sensitive and serious terrorism cases in the UK. So with his experience and knowledge of the way his dad worked, what's his view on the possibility a deal was cut? Could it be that Betchley was given a lenient sentence and further investigations dropped in return for the cup coming back?
Would the police do a deal with somebody at that time? Absolutely. They still do deals with people now, but it is regulated and there is procedures and there's checks that have to be done. And so, again, modern criminal justice is a recognition of the things that you need to do or perhaps that have been done in the past, but realising that if you don't have checks and balances, they can be done in a way that can lead to all sorts of problems. So certainly deals and something of this nature, it's highly likely that if they had the opportunity to do a deal with somebody to recover the World Cup, in advance of the World Cup, and certainly in an unregulated world, it would be too much for anybody to ask not to focus on getting the World Cup back. That would be, I'm sure, that was the greatest pressure on them, was get the World Cup back. So there is plausibility in the circumstance in which this could have arisen. Absolutely. Would it be beyond the realms of possibility that that deal could be done either directly with Betchley or with my father talking to him at the time? It could have potentially been done in either way. It doesn't strike me as it would have been perceived as dishonest by anybody at that time, that if the police had said to, for example, my father at the police station, if he can help us with X, Y and Z, we'll accept a plea of guilty to this, or we'll go easy on bail. Those sorts of things weren't uncommon at all.
Was your father part of your father's great skill and the reason why it sounds like so many people relied on him and rang him in the middle of the night was the fact that he could be trusted to get a deal or to get, I suppose, he'd be trusted for confidentiality, but also he knew people on both sides. So therefore, if I went to him, I would know as a criminal that potentially he would know someone on the other side who he could get a guarantee from. So therefore, he would be an interface that could negotiate on both sides, and both sides could be happy that they knew that it would be a trusting deal.
I think I would put it slightly differently. I think the essence of what you're saying is correct. I think he could be trusted to reach the right outcome for his clients. So my father was scrupulously focused on his role as a defence solicitor, and he did not trust the police. Primarily, there were a few that he did trust that he might have known personally, but fundamentally, he did not trust the police. And so he would have been cautious of being a middleman in quite the way that you describe. But people would phone him up because they knew that there was no one better at getting the best situation possible for them as somebody that was in a police station. And if part of that involved a discussion with the police that ensured representing the interests of his client, he would do that. And so I think it ends up in the same place that you're talking about. And I think that people would trust him. And I think that the police knew that they could trust him not to be dishonest. So he would do his job. But in those days, part of that job was facilitating an outcome.
And the outcome for Bletchley wasn't too bad at all. He was given bail after managing to raise a surety close to £100,000 in today's money, a sizeable sum for a man who was unemployed and had county court debt judgments against him. Who was bankrolling him? And why did the prosecution accept his not guilty pleas on the theft charges when he'd been picked out in an ID parade as being at the scene of the crime? Most importantly, he got a light touch sentence of just 2 years for a charge that could carry up to life. It isn't only the details of Bletchley's case that suggest a deal was cut. Digging through the police files, there are reams of notes and statements up until the morning after the cup was found. Then the police simply stopped investigating. Could it have been that Bletchley had agreed to get the cup back if no more efforts were made to track down the real thief? Ex-Flying Squad detective Peter Kirkham.
They were now desperate to get the cup back, to finish the job off, if you like. Plainly, they'd be putting pressure on the guy they've got hold of. You wanted the money, you were taking us to the cup, you obviously know who's got it, blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to tell you who it is. Didn't expect you to tell us who it is, but I want you to get word to them that somehow it's going to get to us. You would undoubtedly have that conversation. You would undoubtedly put pressure on. You'd probably be twisting a few arms with, we're not going to stop kicking doors in until we find it anyway. That undoubtedly would be the only way forward. So reading what I read, that newspaper article sounds absolutely spot on, that the geezer's rolled over pretty much straight away and agreed to get it sorted out, that it will come back. Obviously, it's not going to come back with somebody holding it who's going to get nicked. So it being found either through a knowing person that knows what they're doing, that accidentally finds it somewhere, or just putting it somewhere where you know it'll be found, and the chances are it'll be someone that's going to go, oh my God, it's the World Cup, I'm going to hand that in. But whether they then pursued it further is another matter, because they still wouldn't have any more evidence other than, oh, it's associates of the guy they've got already, so that isn't going to be enough to convict. So they may call it a day at that if they get the cut back anyway, or that might have been part of the deal. If we get the cut back, we're not going to be looking too much harder for anyone who nicked it, because we're now happy.
If Bletchley had reached a secret agreement with the police to return the cup in exchange for a lesser sentence, how would that have worked in 1966? Patrick Stevens again.
I mean, the mechanism at that time would have been that either the police officer spoke to the judge or put a letter in to the judge. When I first started work, people used to joke about, oh, has a brown, little brown envelope gone in on this one? Now, that practice stopped because there's no checks and balances and no openness and transparency around that system at all. People were not generally allowed to see, even the prosecutor might not be allowed to see what's in the brown envelope. The police officer said that, you know, there's been cooperation, I need the judge to know, but we need to protect this person, so a letter will go in. And I'm going back 30 years now, and a brown envelope would go in. And occasionally, you know, if you get a naive clerk of a court in maybe a magistrate's, I've walked in and there'd be an open court, and someone would say, this is one of those brown envelope cases. And I go, shh, you know, you can't say that. And it would be perfectly possible that if somebody had engineered getting that World Cup to the place where it was discovered, then that information could have been passed on in private, in an envelope to the judge, and the judge could have taken it into account.
Pictures of Betchley on his way to court show him smiling like a man who already knew his fate. Pickle's owner, Dave Corbett, was a witness at Betchley's committal hearing at Bow Street Magistrates Court. Dave described how the defendant did not look like a man facing the prospect of a long prison sentence.
When he was in court, the guy, he just kept laughing at the judge.
Who was laughing at the judge? Betchley was laughing at the judge.
Yeah.
Don't worry. So that would support the theory then that he'd spoken to the police and said to them, well, if you let me see my girlfriend,
yeah,
I'll get the cut back and then you can have a word with the judge, drop the... Because he was charged with the actual theft as well originally, but they dropped those charges.
Oh, did they?
Yes. So it would all fit into him having done a deal with the police to get the cut back.
That's what the cop said to me. He said, first thing, got to get the cut back.
At all costs?
At all costs, yeah.
Yeah.
I think they was thinking of the Queen. She can't give them a false cut, can she? I think politics come into it and all. Mustn't it, you know, from up above. You know, God, what's the Queen going to give? You know how they think, politicians.
For the police and the FA, they had the cutback. All of the security failings and blunders could be forgotten about. And Dave has a point. Let's remember the political backdrop to all this. Days away from an election, the government would have been putting pressure on the police. Careers were on the line. You're listening to Stealing Victory. I'll be back after a short break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is Stealing Victory. So what do we know of the Met in 1966? And in particular, those at the flying squad who led this investigation.
I did a lot of work over 15, 20 years on police corruption. And it's a tremendously difficult area to work in because, you know, you are dealing with people who really know how to protect themselves and they don't generally make it very obvious that they're taking money. So you have to, you know, you have to find all sorts of ways to prove the story.
Dr. Paul Lashmar is the head of the Department of Journalism at City University in London. He continues to be an investigative journalist and spent many years probing the police and intelligence services. He is also the co-author of Scotland Yard's Cocaine Connection, an expose of previous links between organised crime and detectives in the Met.
What's interesting about the World Cup case, of course, this is really early in terms of police corruption being made public. So the police officers involved wouldn't have been thinking about whether it would be made public because everything was kept. They knew at that point they could keep the lid on things. So a corrupt police officer of 1966 would be pretty sure that nothing untoward was going to happen. They weren't going to be taped. They weren't going to be grassed up. It was too high a risk for the criminals at that point because it hadn't got to the tipping point that it did later, where the police were taking so much money that the criminals had enough from, they took the view that it was actually worth reporting the police because, you know, they were going to do 15 years and have to pay a lot of money anyway. So what's there to lose?
They would have felt fairly untouchable, the police at that point, in terms of there wasn't really any oversight at all. The media weren't there looking at them. There was no police complaints authority and you didn't get recorded. You weren't even, I don't know if you're entitled to a solicitor either. So it could be that you could pretty much do what you wanted as a detective.
Well, indeed. But the only thing, if you were a criminal, you're entitled to was a beating at that time. So, you know, that was fairly routine, if getting knocked about. Who investigated corrupt police officers? Other police officers from the same force. What was their rate of success? Very low. That's a surprise.
All that began to change in November 1969 when the Times splashed on a brilliant piece of investigative journalism. It alleged that Yard detectives took bribes from criminals and helped them to escape charges. The reporters had nailed the story by obtaining tape recordings of bent officers. One captured a detective giving advice to a young villain, which we've recreated here.
Don't forget to let me know straight away if you need anything, because I know people everywhere. Because I'm in a little firm, in a firm. Don't matter where, anywhere in London, I can get on the phone to someone I know, I can trust, that talks the same as me. And if he's not the right person who can do it, he'll know the person that can. All right. That's the thing. And it can work well. It's worked well for years, hasn't it? We've got more villains in our game than you've got in yours.
Well, what's extraordinary in that period is how much freedom, once you got into a specialist squad and were known as a thief taker, you were given huge flexibility to go about, what you know, nicking people. And there was very little in the way of having to account for it. Of course, you had to produce statements if you interviewed someone. You had to produce evidence. But it was all very vague. And, of course, it wasn't recorded. So if you wanted to put some away, you'd write a script that said that they'd confessed to you. And that this, you know, was the way that you put away people. When you talk about corrupt police officers, you're not talking about officers who don't put anybody away, in, you know, don't send people to prison. The most corrupt officers are also the most effective thief takers. But what they're doing is they're licensing. And what the Yard became really good at was licensing crime. So the deal was that you essentially identify major players, you then do a deal with them, and you make arrangements whereby they pay you off and you put favours their way. So they make more money, they give you more money, you then knock out their opposition. And what they do is they give you bodies to put away who aren't first-class criminals, they're second-class criminals, but it still looks good.
So it's fair to say that in 1966, it wasn't a simple case of good cops catching bad villains. It was a world in which the boundary between right and wrong was blurred, and the fallout from the Times story would eventually result in a number of detectives being investigated for corruption. Among them was a detective inspector, Len Buggy, the hero officer who had won a commendation for retrieving the World Cup. Buggy found himself in the dock at Wells Street Magistrate Court in Highbury in January 1977. He died in June the following year while awaiting trial, aged just 60, the Daily Telegraph reported.
A flying squad detective who had since died shared thousands of pounds with a police informer paid by a man to secure his acquittal on a receiving charge, the prosecution at Middlesex Crown Court alleged yesterday. But Mrs. Pamela Shaw, who had been instructed to appear for Detective Inspector Charles Leonard Buggy, said he would have strenuously denied the accusations made against him.
Buggy had been accused of plotting with a solicitor and police informer to secure the acquittal of a man said to have been found in possession of stolen stamps valued at up to £30,000. The allegation dated back to 1968. An informant told anti-corruption officers that Buggy was paid thousands of pounds to straighten out the allegations, in other words, to make them go away. Buggy's friend and junior colleague Alec East was also said to have been in on the scam. Buggy owned a number of laundrettes in southeast London, and his reputation was intimately linked to Alec East, said to be among the most corrupt Met detectives ever. Though East was never convicted, he faced a slew of allegations and was demoted to uniform duties before retiring.
Alec East was another classic thief taker turned corrupt police officer, which over the years I've had so much information come to me about Alec East and his criminality. Very effective thief taker because he had fantastic contacts. He was a very big personality and he was given completely free rein to do what he wanted. But he turns up everywhere, and he is said to be the officer, you know, the famous Baker Street robbery, which is seen as the precursor for the 2015 Hatton Garden robbery, where they did exactly that in the Lloyds Bank on the corner of Baker Street, where they tunnelled in and all that. He was the first officer, senior officer, to get in there, and it's said that they'd left a gift for him, essentially, for him to pick up. One of the smart moves you could do as a bent police officer is if you knew a big robbery was going off, that you got advance warning, you'd make sure you were the duty officer. So you were the most senior person sent to the scene. And For instance, if they were people that were paying you, then you'd make sure there was no evidence found. You know, it was that kind of arrangement. And this is what the allegation with East was.
Alec East wasn't involved in the World Cup case. However, his track record has serious implications for our understanding of Buggy, because in 1968, Buggy brought East onto his team at the Flying Squad. So would Buggy have known about East being suspected of corruption?
Oh, God, yeah. You know, the way you got taken into a squad or a department is they would know who you were. You know, it wasn't in those days, you didn't get into the robbery squad because it was your turn or that you'd done a good exam or anything. You had to know people. There had to be evidence that you were likely to fit. So to get into any kind of serious CID operation, if Len Buggy is recruiting East, he must have known he was bent, and it was a thief taker, but bent. He must have known that. I just can't believe he wouldn't. It was hardly a secret in the Met at any point. And you would think that was what they were looking for. I mean, the most corrupt officers were often the best thief takers because they traded and they were very commercially successful.
But just to be clear then, that doesn't mean that Buggy was necessarily corrupt. It just means potentially that he would have known that East would have made him look good.
It's a fool or knave argument. Either Buggy was a fool if he didn't know that East was bent, or he knew full well and knew he'd bring enough bodies to make it look good for him and his department. It's hard to think of someone like Buggy not knowing. It really is at that point. East's reputation preceded him by the time he's a detective sergeant.
But Buggy would have known that East was corrupt when he brought him in 68. Would he have been worried about that infecting his department, or it would have meant that he already knew that it existed in his department?
Well, of course, I can't tell you what Buggy thought. That's not amongst my range of journalistic skills. but what it looks to, you know, this is the firm within the firm at the absolute peak in 68. There is immense criminality across the Met. Not everywhere, as I said to you before, but, you know, there were a lot of departments had a lot of bent people. And the way it worked was patronage. If you were known to be a thief taper and you would take a bung and people would all benefit, then you'd get a slot in a particular unit. It was very unusual for a bent officer to be brought into a department that was known to be straight. Everything you're telling me indicates that Buggy was probably a member of, you know, was within the firm, within a firm. I'd be very surprised if he wasn't. Mm-hmm. But I don't have substantive evidence, but except that I've heard his name loads as a corrupt officer.
Now let's turn our focus back on Ted Betchley. He was a petty criminal trapped way out of his depth in one of the most high-profile cases of the century. But in his corner, he had an unparalleled team.
I always think that the story of my father and Jeremy Hutchinson is one of the great love stories never told.
That's Patrick Stevens again, talking about his dad Harry Stevens and the barrister Jeremy Hutchinson, a legend of the bar who was said to have inspired John Mortimer's TV defence barrister Horace Rumpole of Rumpole of the Bailey.
My dad was, obviously I'm a huge fan, as you might imagine, but he was someone who would never knowingly admit that someone was better than him at something, and he would never acknowledge that somebody was funnier or better, certainly better in the law than him, with one or two notable exceptions, and the top of that list was Jeremy Hutchinson. He worshipped the ground that Jeremy Hutchinson walked on. He would speak of him in the most glowing terms, just how wonderful he was. And I think what it was apart from being a brilliant, brilliant lawyer, Jeremy Hutchinson was also someone who was from a completely different walk of life that perhaps my father never thought he would ever encounter. Someone who was from the higher echelons of society, you know, moved in the Bloomsbury set with all of these famous people, but was a passionate socialist, of which my father was also a passionate socialist. And he was not used to being treated as an equal by someone from that strata of society. And whilst they were never mates to the extent that he would go round his house, they didn't have that type of relationship at all. In work, there was the most incredible common bond and mutual respect.
At Harry Stevens' surprise 70th birthday celebration in 1992, the family had organised a This Is Your Lifestyle tribute with friends sharing their stories. Jeremy Hutchinson couldn't make it in person, but he sent a video message.
Doesn't look as if I'm going to be able to get to your party, which is a great sadness.
In the grainy camcorder footage from the party, Harry is visibly moved. As Jeremy's message is played on the TV, he jolts upright and leans in to listen.
And the fact of the matter is that you just were the best instructing solicitor of the lot.
The audio is hard to make out on this old tape, but while praising Harry's professionalism and sense of humour, it was the following clip which made Harry shake his head in emotional disbelief.
And if I had any success at the criminal bar, I have to say that it's very largely due to you and Baldwin and your loyalty to Chambers, and I'm very pleased to be able to put that on the record.
If I had any success at the criminal bar, I have to say it was down to you and Baldwin, he says. So there you have one of the most respected defence barristers of the 20th century, a man of legend in the Old Bailey, hailing from the upper echelons of society, attributing his success to the work of Harry Stevens and Freddie Baldwin, two working-class boys from the slums of Bermondsey. And it was this unlikely team that represented Betchley when he finally appeared in the wood-panelled surroundings of Court No. 1 at the Old Bailey. We've previously heard from barrister and author Thomas Grant. He got to know Jeremy during the later part of his life and authored the book Jeremy Hutchinson's Case Histories, From Lady Chatterley's Lover to Howard Marks. For Thomas, Betchley's defence was exactly the kind of fight he loved to take on.
This case, in terms of Jeremy's practice, it kind of fits into a larger pattern of doing cases which, on the page in the newspaper, have the sense of a kind of a slightly crazy guy kicking against the establishment. You know, the idea that he was able to, or he or whoever it was able to steal from the Central Methodist Hall, which, as I read the newspapers at the time, was being guarded by two people at any one time, if not four people at any one time. How he managed to get through all these kind of waves of guards has a sort of Ealing comedy quality about it, has a certain Italian Job quality about it.
Among his cases were some of the most important of the era. He defended double agent George Blake, Christine Keeler, great train robber Charlie Wilson, and Kempton Bunton, the only man to steal a picture from the National Gallery, and drug trafficker Howard Marks. His legal prowess and powers of persuasion can be seen in his closing speech at Betchley's trial, which may have saved him extra time in jail.
I'm just looking at the Guardian's report of the hearing in front of the judge, Mr. Justice Lyle, in the Old Bailey, where Jeremy was mitigating on behalf of Ted Betchley, and is reported as saying, and I quote, "Happily the cup is back and happily no harm has been done. Next week the competition starts." And it then is reported, "He asked the judge to impose a penalty," and again I quote, "which will not cast any shadow over the field of play." What the hell that means, I've no idea, but it must have sounded wonderful at the time.
Fellow lawyer Patrick Stevens has an idea of what Jeremy Hutchinson was alluding to.
I love that. That's really skillful. I think that's really skillful because it's an entirely unfair burden to put on the judge. But it's entirely true that if they'd given him a savage sentence, people might have been talking about that rather than the festival of football that was about to come up. So I think it's a very clever thing to make the judge think, oh, well, I don't want to be the man that ruined the World Cup for England. And so I think that's a fantastic line and a very, very... No wonder my dad thought Jeremy Hutchinson was so good.
So it's the psychology of the barrister to not necessarily be brilliant at law, but just to be able to work out how to argue things to work on people's conscience.
Yeah, that's a wonderful, subtle and diplomatic piece of emotional blackmail. It's sort of saying you could ruin all of this for everybody if you give him a 7-year prison sentence.
For over 5 decades, Betchley remained the only person ever to be named or charged in relation to the theft. He died soon after he was released from his 2-year jail sentence. But as we've seen from the evidence, it's clear Betchley was a sidekick at best, a patsy at worst, who took the fall for others. My investigations in the archives and conversations with Frank Baldwin only made me more determined to find this elusive Sidney Q. But before we get to that, there's more to the story of the fate of the World Cup in 1966. Did Bobby Moore lift the replica or the real one when England were victorious?
And I took the real one off him. I turned and walked straight out and then put it in the boot of the car.
And who walked away with more than £250,000 decades after the theft?
Twice. So, at £254,500.
Stealing Victory is an original Audi production. If you've enjoyed listening, then please do like us on your podcast app, leave a review and subscribe. Our hashtag is Stealing Victory, all one word. More information can be found at audi.co/stealingvictory. Stealing Victory is written and hosted by me, Tom Pettifor, with thanks to everyone at the Daily Mirror for their support during the investigation. Sound design is by Norman Goodman. Theme music by Nick Reynolds and Edward Rose. Title music by Guy Farley. Executive editor is Owen Bennett-Jones. Editor-in-chief, Andrew Sampson. And series producer is Zach Brophy.